Welcome back, guys, to the A-List Lowdown coming at you April 2nd, so not April Fool's Day. We didn't do a show on April Fool's Day because nobody would take us seriously. We're coming back at you April 2nd, Wednesday, April 2nd, 2025 with Crookfield and pole vaulting, which I think is, well, I already know because he told me is like a pollster thing, a play on the polls. I thought I heard something today about the cons being back up in the polls.
Well, I don't know. This isn't a full poll analysis. It's just to show some tomfoolery going on with the polls, and just to basically just be careful of what you're looking at in the polls. I mean, this is, and I got an article going back 2 years and some examples of current polls, which are creepy as F, creepy AF, and It's not a full, like, I'm not analyzing, oh, where the polls have been and for this and that. It's more of a deeper dive, like a deconstruction of how they're made. What do you want to do? What do you want to start off with? I mean, what an interesting time right now. Carney and Pierre going at it. It seems like Pierre is starting to ramp up a little bit. I mean, he's getting these big rallies and everybody's, it's not showing in the polls. It's there's a disparity happening here. That's why I think it's important to talk about it right now.
Yeah, it seems like there's a real possibility that he might win some ridings in like PEI and stuff.
And I got to tell you, I predicted this happening with the polls and with the. I mean, I predicted Carney would squeak a win though. This is back before we knew what was happening, like last year. But I said that. I said that we'll lose like a small percentage from where it was at to the Liberals from the Conservatives, and then the polls will make it look super close, and then they'll squeak, they'll steal it, squeak it, squeak it in. But I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I don't know if it's going to go to that end or not.
Do they use the machines in Canada?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's all paper.
Do they use them because I know in Alberta they only do paper. Do they? Is that like coast to coast?
I think so. Yeah. So definitely harder to manipulate.
It seems harder, yeah, because every time I've voted, it's been on a piece of paper.
Probably didn't need to, right? Because they get whatever Ontario and Quebec wants anyways, right? So why do you need to even, set up? You just let the West do whatever they want, and it's not going to matter, so.
The Americans complain about their voter ID stuff here. I got to go and give them my ID, and I have to go to a certain booth, and they'll look up my name to make sure that I'm in the right address, and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's a whole rigmarole to voting around here. So, I mean, it seems like it's harder than the States, I would say, for sure. You definitely ain't just walking in off the street. You need to have definitely your ID, for sure. Okay.
And maybe this is why the polls are such a mess right now, because this is the way they have to manipulate it, because they don't have as much control over the each riding and what's happening in each one like they do in the States. You know, they can't manipulate each little one as much. I mean, it's just usually it's whatever happens in the East. So now if the East is falling apart and they're losing some key ridings, then they're starting to freak. So then they bring out this polling manipulation.
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
then they get people that don't want to vote, right? If people think, the Liberals are going to win, then they won't go out and vote. Or they don't want to vote for somebody that's going to lose. So then they decide, all those people that are on the fence decide to vote Liberal because they look like they're winning.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, is that what people do? They just vote for whoever they think is winning.
I think it's a psychological manipulation that's happening. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, if that's how easy it is to manipulate the public, then we deserve the government we get, I guess. I don't know what else to say about that. At this point, I say let him win it. Let Carney have it. I mean, the separatism. We're having a guy on tomorrow about from the Alberta Separatist Party, the Secession Party. Start talking about that. The fervor is through the roof. There's referendum talk. I mean, part of me is like, man, it'd almost be a shame to put the lid back on this.
I know it's a tough one because you still kind of want PP in there to slow things down a little bit. Just slow the train down a bit,
Maybe I'll play this clip. Let's see if it works.
Two issues which are kind of interconnected. One is the trade corridor discussion, and the other one is the tariffs. How would any new trade or energy corridors actually help Alberta during this time of tariffs? And separately but connected to it, What do you expect to see from the U.S. administration tomorrow when it comes to tariffs?
I'll finish with the last one first. It's hard to predict the U.S. president, and I don't really want to get ahead of myself because I don't want to you never want to be wrong. But my inclination from what I've heard from different administration officials is that it looks like it's just going to be sectoral application for the most part, and then they talk about reciprocal tariffs, and so. We don't have any tariffs on their oil and gas. So I'm assuming that means that they're not going to have tariffs on our oil and gas. I think for the bulk of our food production, with the exception of supply management, I think we also don't have tariffs. So I would expect that our food production should also be tariff-free. He's quite clearly concerned about the auto sector, pharmaceuticals, semiconductors, steel, aluminum, and timber and supply managed industries. So I'll be watching to see what that looks like there. But we've been making the argument that raw materials and intermediate goods should not be tariffed at all because those go into making value added products. And I'm hopeful that's what I'm hoping to see tomorrow. But we really just won't know until we see the result. They seem to be, I've been saying this from the beginning, they seem to be really irritated by national sales taxes because, of course, the Americans, although they have state and local sales taxes, they don't have a national sales tax. So if you read any of the work of the economists advising the president, it seems like that our GST or harmonized sales tax is what they really look at as a form of tariff. It isn't, but that's how they're looking at it. So that's maybe where it might end up falling, is if they're going to try to put a border adjustment tax in that's equivalent to that, that would be what I'll be looking for tomorrow.
All right, so we're listening to the Premier of Alberta, Danielle Smith. She's being asked questions about that had a lot of issues. Now, of course,
all right, let's stop that one and let's jump over to this one, which I thought was the one I was going to play.
No, I can't hear it.
What? No, this is good. This is impossible.
I know. It's so.
I just went from one tab to the other. Well, my browser has lost connection to my screen share audio. Try sharing again.
Whoa, what is going on with your internet? Elon!
That's not Elon, that's StreamYard, man. I'm blaming StreamYard for almost all of it now because I literally have no problems outside of this.
And I just did a test earlier and it worked one time and not the other time. It's getting very frustrating.
All I did is switch tabs. I went from one tab to the other tab.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's more Danielle Smith. I was in Brooks today. I
was going to say that, yeah.
There is a process for individuals to put those questions forward so that every Albertan can have a say.
Responding to a question on support for separation, Alberta's premier says she is looking to hear from all Albertans post-election, giving voters a chance to raise any issue, including leaving Canada.
I'm calling it now the What's Next panel. We just want to go around the province, see how people are feeling, and see if there are any other referendum issues that they want us to put on the table.
An idea that might sound familiar.
Albertans have been working.
I mean, let's be honest. She knows exactly what she's saying. You know, there's only one thing Albertans are really saying they want a referendum on right now. Maybe two, if you counted joining the states.
Working for Ottawa for too long. It's time for Ottawa to start working for us.
In 2019, then Premier Jason Kenney launched a 9-person fair deal panel to get Alberta a better deal within Canada. This political scientist says while the two panels might sound similar, they are not.
This seems to be a specific attempt to gin up anti-Ottawa, anti-liberal attitudes.
Gin it up, baby.
What? It isn't even over yet.
Smith's panel proposal comes within.
That's a, you know, he's ginning up. I mean, who even says that anymore? I think they're going to read this tweet, so I don't have to.
Weeks of her threat of an unprecedented national unity crisis if the next PM doesn't meet her 9 demands within 6 months.
Stoking national unity crises that don't currently exist is certainly something new.
Those don't exist right now, Graham. Did you know
that? Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Everything is hunky-dory. Okay.
For the Premier of Alberta, and should be worrisome not only for the next Prime Minister, but for all Canadians.
I think she's articulating the so far unarticulated sentiments of most Albertans. Easterners just don't get it.
Albertan sentiments will be articulated in the upcoming election. Recent polling puts our province at odds with most of the country, showing conservatives with 53% support on the prairies versus 36% across the rest of Canada, with Mark Carney leading across Canada as preferred PM with 47%. That support drops down to 29% in our region.
We're fully aware that we have been treated very badly by Laurentian Canada since before we were even provinces. So it's not alienation. It's just there's only so much you can take.
Canadians head to the polls April
28th. I would agree. Even on the panel we were on there for a little bit there about 51 or not, it was kind of misconstrued because there wasn't anybody for 51, but there was some Alberta separation people there. But the guys back east that kept talking, they just didn't get it. They just kind of sloughed off our concerns again. They really did seem like it's the first time I kind of listened to them talking about it. And they just felt like they were in their bubble, just in their back east bubble. They're just like, oh yeah, no, we don't think like, dude, let me play one. This is about the same thing. Historical attempts aside, this is from Alberta Secession Why. Just recently, 63% of Albertans vote in favor of amending equalization, right? Ignored. Alberta asks for a measurement of its share of CPP. Ignored. Daniel Smith stands up for Alberta's interests, not a team player, traitor, betraying Canada. Keith Wilson, this was a response to Keith Wilson's post. He says, Alberta's spent decades seeking fair representation in Canada, Ontario, and Quebec. They don't care.
In 2021, I wrote No Other Option. Determination for Alberta, that's my case for Alberta independence. So it's different from the other one in terms of presenting the case. And then I thought that would be my final book on the independence issue. What I found was that people who would read No Other Option would say, yeah, you know, it'd be good if Alberta became independent, but before we do that, we need to try and fix Canada first. And that really frustrated me because...
Sound familiar?
That's right.
Albertans have been trying to fix Canada for several decades, and it seemed to me many people had forgotten what we've done in the past to try and make things better in Canada. So the time to leave is specifically arguing that we have tried very hard, you know, at least since the early 1980s, for Alberta to get its voice within Canada, and that everything that we've tried has failed, not because the people weren't trying hard enough or doing a good job, but because the political power in Canada is concentrated in central Canada, which is Ontario and Quebec, and they're not interested in what we have to say. They're not interested in our grievances with the central government.
That's exactly like the videos we're putting out on A-List, right? Talking about the power concentrated over there, and the provinces really don't have a say.
Because they already have the power. They can completely ignore us, and it makes no impact. And so that's what they have done.
An increasing number of Albertans see independence through referendum as a way to give their kids and grandkids a prosperous future. I could read a couple comments here. The notion this would ever happen via referendum is childish pablum. The U.S. colonies didn't ask the British Empire if there was a legal application process to separate from the empire. Albertans need to give their balls a tug and man up. Alberta Declaration of Independence. We want a peaceful exit, Ray. A majority referendum backed by the U.S. will do it. That's all we need. There you go. I can't hear you. You're muted.
I got a couple interesting ones here. Let's jump with this, which just came up because today's Liberation Day, whatever that ended up meaning. But here it is in the Epoch Times. Canada avoids new Trump tariffs while border-related penalties remain in place. So U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled his long-promised plan seeking to rebalance global trade with reciprocal U.S. tariffs on April 2nd, but didn't impose new tariffs on Canada. Interesting. All right, let's just take a break from that one and jump over here.
President Trump has just announced a series of measures that are going to fundamentally change the international trading system. Now, in doing so, he has preserved a number of important elements of our relationship, the commercial relationship between Canada and the United States. But the fentanyl tariffs still remain in place, as do the tariff for steel and aluminum. As of this evening, the tariffs on automobiles will enter into force. And the U.S. has signaled
So remember that's actually that there's a carve out, and it's only based on how many U.S. car parts are in your thing. There's a giant carve out for Canada and all this stuff that he's not mentioned.
That there will be.
Wait. What are fentanyl tariffs? Like literally those ones that were initially
25%. Yeah.
Okay. And he's just calling them fentanyl tariffs.
Fent tariffs.
Strategic sectors, pharmaceuticals, lumber, and semiconductors.
Which we provide 0.8% of the U.S. Semiconductors.
Who's making all the noise? Who's making all the noise?
We're in a situation.
Hold on there.
Where there's going to be an impact on the U.S. economy, which will build with time. In our judgment, it will be negative on the U.S. economy. That will have an impact on us. But the series of measures will directly affect millions of Canadians. We're going to fight these tariffs with countermeasures. We are going to protect our workers, and we are going to build the strongest economy in the G7. In a crisis, it's important to come together, and it's essential to act with purpose and with force, and that's what we will do.
It was the best economy in the world last time he said it. Now it's like he's like, I better tone that down a bit. In the G7. Oh, come on, dude. We are so far behind. It's impossible. It's broken.
Good luck even getting that, right? Okay, so let's switch back to this because we didn't get any new tariffs. Senior White House official said the initial broad 25% tariff placed on goods from Canada and Mexico in relation to illegal migration and fentanyl trafficking will remain in place. The current exemption for goods covered by the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, the USMCA free trade deal implemented on March 6, also remain in place. And we have a 10% tariff on our energy oil. At this time, Canada and Mexico, they continue to be the subject of national emergency related to fentanyl migration, and that tariff regime will persist while those conditions persist.
That's so nothing about fixing those conditions, right? We're just gonna fight back with more tariffs, right? Nothing about actually fixing the problem. Like nobody's yet in that part of the government is addressed. I think Daniel Smith and Mo are the only ones that have addressed the problems in that one type of tariff there that he's talking about.
That's right. The reciprocal tariffs for other countries include 34% on China, 26% on India, 24% on Japan, 20% on the European Union, and 10% on the United Kingdom and Australia. During a speech at the White House on April 2nd, Trump said the tariffs would be the country's declaration of economic independence and will give the U.S. government trillions of dollars in tariff revenue while bringing jobs and factories roaring back to the country. The United States is seeking to address its trade deficit, which stood at just over $918 billion. Trump singled out Canada specifically for its supply management system, saying the country imposes tariffs as high as 300%. For its dairy products. When you look at it a little bit, it's not a pretty picture and we don't like it. It's not fair to our farmers. It's not fair to our country. So let's just jump that over to this while everyone's freaking out about tariffs and finish up the tariff talk here. So here's some reciprocal tariff examples. What do you expect to find here? The U.S. just being a big bully?
Oh, man. Examples of what? From Canada to the U.S. or from...
No, this is just all around the world.
There's a ton of them are all around the world. It's unbelievable, actually.
Let's go through a list of them. So below is a sample of the tariffs imposed on dozens of countries assessed by the United States as having higher trade barriers. So the first is going to be the country. The first slide is the country and the tariff they're currently charging to the U.S. And then the second will be the reciprocal tariff that the U.S. is now charging. So let's go down the list. We got Cambodia was charging a 97% tariff against the U.S., and now the U.S. is coming at 49%. Vietnam was charging a 90% tariff, is charging 90% tariff, so the U.S. is doing 46%. Sri Lanka, 88%, so the U.S. does 44%. It looks like they decided to go in at about half of what all the other countries are charging them. So it's not too much of a shock on their consumer. Bangladesh, 74%. The U.S. is 34%. Big one, China's charging 67% average tariff on U.S. imports. So U.S. is now doing a 34%. Switzerland, 61-31. Indonesia, 64-32. Taiwan, 64-32. South Africa, 60-30. Pakistan, 58-29. I mean, it's exactly half. So the U.S. is now charging half of the tariff that other countries are charging them. And people are freaking out. The European 39-20, Philippines 34-17, Israel 33-17, and Malaysia 47-24. Japan 46-24. So I just thought that was
well, and the main thing is, I think the main reason is because of the trade deficit, right? Because, and this is why, this is, I don't know if it's correct that he calls it like we're subsidizing, he's subsidizing us, but there's just hundreds of billions of dollars that like we're not allowed, like the US can't sell to the world, but the US is the biggest consumer and they're buying from all over. So everybody can go ahead and sell all their stuff to the US, but the US can't sell back. Why isn't this, why can't people just talk about it like that? Why can't it just be, I don't know, it gets frustrating.
I agree. Do you want to do your poll thing now?
Yeah, I'll do the poll thing. So
then I'll do the field thing.
Yeah, well, here's an example of, so I'm going to give a couple examples of the polls. One of them we played on our Outlawed, so it's going to be a bit of a repeat from other podcasts, but I'm not, it's only going to be a few seconds, but it's that poll about the actual audio clip of the poll. But this is one that's going around on the internet here. Here's what I got in a poll emailed to me today. I want to know what you think of this, Darren, by one of Canada's well-known pollsters. The poll was ridiculous. This question is not fabricated or doctored in any way. Yes, polls are misleading thanks to the questions asked. So here's this surveys.angusreedforum.com. So now we'll turn to some reasons people give to support or oppose some of the parties in the upcoming election. You've been chosen to hear about Mark Carney and the Liberals. Which of the following statement comes closest to your own view on why people should vote Liberal in the next election, even if none is exactly right? Isn't that weird wording right off the bat?
Yes.
Doesn't it seem like this? Pierre Poilievre is a radical extremist who would risk the rights of Canadians. We cannot let him win and become prime minister. The only way to stop them is to vote for Mark Carney and the Liberals. They're the only ones high enough in the polls to stop the Conservatives. That's one option right there. The second option, Pierre Poilievre would bow down to Trump and let him walk all over Canada. He wants to privatize our healthcare. To be more like for-profit America care. He wants you to pay for your health care. This can't be real. We have to stop him at any cost. The Liberals are the best place to challenge him. Mark Carney is the best guy to stand up to Trump. None of the above or don't know, not sure. I mean, is that... I mean, apparently it's real. I mean, I guess it is, but it's just... Doesn't it feel weird to you? So here's the Echoes poll. This is from Northern Perspective. This is the one that you played before, right? So this is going to be a couple questions. So they recorded the call that came in from Echoes. And this will kind of blow you away too. And we'll talk a little bit about it. But it's going to ask here, it's going to start asking in the clip, would you describe you and your household as poor, working class, middle class, or wealthy? So I wanted to know what you thought about this too.
I can't hear it.
You can't hear it, eh? That's why I stopped it, just to make sure. StreamYard, we have to figure this out. This is getting really annoying. I'm gonna click on and off a tab that says share audio. This is where we're at.
Press one for poor. Press two for.
Got it? Okay, so I'm just gonna go back to the.
Would you describe you and your household as poor, working class, middle class, or upper class?
I mean, since when is there four classes? Do you ever think there's like, now they're splitting up the working class and the middle class, I guess? They're just
together. Middle class was the working class.
Well, yeah, me too. I mean, it's just poor, middle class, or upper class, right? Wasn't the working class supposed to be the middle class? That was what the middle class became, I thought. I mean, this is, I don't know. I'm not trying to nitpick this. It's just weird to me.
Press one for poor. Press two for working class. Press three for middle class. Do you consider yourself to be a member of a visible minority? Press one for
would you say yes? I guess you would,
or no.
I guess.
Repeat the you consider yourself to be an Indigenous person? Press 1 for yes. Press 2 for no. And are you a person with a disability? Press 1 for yes. Press 2 for no. Press 9 to repeat this question. Are you currently a member of a labor union? Press 1 for yes, a private sector union. Press 2 for yes, a public sector union. Or press 3 for no. What is the language that you first learned at home?
Did I miss the
Press 1 for English. Have you immigrated to Canada within the last 10 years? Press 1 for yes.
Oh, I missed the whole vaccine part. Hang on a sec.
Yeah, that's later.
Is it later on the thing, or
it's earlier, way earlier?
For none, press 2 for 1 or 2.
Okay, let me just find it quickly then. Sorry about the delay here.
Have you received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, rural party?
So weird.
Press 3 for conservative party. Have you received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine? Please listen carefully to all options before selecting your answer. Press 1 for yes, 1 or 2 doses. Press 2 for yes, 3 doses or more. Press 3 for no.
So they're asking if you've been jabbed, COVID jab, 1 or 2 or more plus the boosters or no. I mean, why would they do this? And you threw out to me, like, I wasn't even thinking this far, but you're like, well, the way they're weighting it is they can just take people that answer no right out of this in some weird way, right? I mean, how can they even ask the question to begin with? Legally, like, how is that allowed to, you know, I mean, I guess you can do whatever you want in these polls, but.
I don't think you can ask people who they're going to vote for.
Didn't it say wasn't the beginning about that, about who they're going to vote for? But why would they want your vaccination status then? Besides knowing like who they're losing, like out of all the jabbed people, who they're losing to the other party, like maybe they can say, oh, these people were obviously they were liberal before their jab, now they're moved over. Or is it so that they can actually filter and weigh the results, take the jabbed out, like you said, take the non-jabbed out and then just count all the jabbed? I mean, is that even a thing? Would they be able to do that? Could they use that? Is there a technicality in there somewhere that says they didn't comply with this and they're not eligible for this poll?
I think that they could, yeah. I think, like you said, it's their poll. They could do whatever they want.
All right. So here's, I'm going to stop and share again here. So this is what I want to talk about here. This is the polling here that, these polls are an attempt to manufacture consent in Canada and in no way an accurate representation of Canadian opinion. So this is an old article from September 2022, so Stormhaven Media. And I remember hearing about this, but I don't know if I heard it on No Agenda or why I kind of took why I just didn't think that it was, you know, I just didn't think that it was I don't know, possible that it's happening that much, but I'm going to read I highlighted a PDF here for it. So I want to know what you think of this, consent manufacturing industry. So on January 19th, Canadian Press published a poll asserting that fully 3/4 of Canadians apparently welcome being locked down, locked in their homes, and would like all citizens. Let me just pull this up here. This is not cooperating with me. I'm going to have to widen it a little bit. And would like all their fellow citizens locked up as well. We have been bombarded with polls like this informing us how eager Canadians are to surrender every right they have in the name of the dreaded COVID. We are, according to the data, not only willing to see every minute aspect of our economic and social lives controlled, but quite happy about it. This, like much of what's happened around us in the last year, is an artificially created reality. When you check leisure, so this is one of the ones that's doing it nowadays, right? When you check leisure's own methodology for the poll being cited, they surveyed 2,519 people. They surveyed about Canadians favoring curfews. 1,003 of them, and 40% were American. That is probably the least duplicitous thing about this data. These polls are an attempt to manufacture consent in Canada for even more repressive and, in fact, increasingly deadly public health measures, and in no way an accurate representation of Canadian opinion. And here's how it done. Here's how it's done. The cited poll was done by Leisure Marketing and a think tank called Association for Canadian Studies. Let's start with Leisure Marketing. Is it Ledger? Ledger Marketing?
I don't know. I think it's Ledger.
That's how they've been pronouncing it these days in the new 2025 regime. So if we go to actual Ledger survey being quoted, we are told the data was collected from a representative sample, right? A representative sample of 1,516 Canadians and 1,003 American over the age of 18, selected from Leo's Ledger Marketing representative panel. That is where things get interesting, because Leo is a pool of paid, rigorously pre-selected survey respondents who gain reward points for every survey they do. The more surveys, the more points. So here's your reward. So you could do it, as a little part-time job here. Starbucks, PayPal, Uber, you get some points for these things. Your total Leo points there. Oh, my cat decided to come now. This is where it gets really interesting. Before becoming part of the pool, you must go through a filtering process by filling out a questionnaire. Much of this questionnaire is laser focused on favored themes wrapped around identity. The first open survey you can take measures your attitudes in fine detail toward COVID-19. The next several surveys you take for points require incredibly detailed information about your education, employment, and economic status. It is the highly detailed information contained in these surveys and your recorded reactions that will decide if your opinion is required, in turn giving Ledger Marketing exactly the opinion they need. Don't worry about the other half of Canadians public opinion manufacturing duopoly. Okay, so when they need it, I think is what it said there. So don't worry, the other half of Canada's public opinion manufacturing duopoly, Ipsos, has its own identical shell game going on over at the cringingly named isay.com. Its world is the same way, offering rewards to a filtered online panel. This is a huge departure from both the history and the current perception of how opinions in society are measured. The polls that we all grew up with are known as probability sampling. Probability sampling is defined as a sampling technique in which the researcher chooses samples from a larger population using a method based on the theory of probability, right? We all kind of realize that, right? You take this wide sample and then it's supposed to give you, you're supposed to be able to expand it out to everybody, right? Even though you only ask 1,000 or 2,000 people, it's supposed to be a varied enough sample that you get an accurate representation. For a participant to be considered as a probability sample,
which I think is just a flaw in the whole thing, impossible. I think that society is too chaotic to pick that, 0.01% of the population and expect it to be accurate.
Maybe that's changed. I mean, it seemed to have used to work. I mean, I think there was a science behind all this. It's based on the theory of probability. Anyways, where the researcher chooses samples from a larger population using a method based on the theory of probability. Yeah, for a participant to be considered as a probability sample, he or she must be selected using a random selection. So it was about random selections, right? An example of this would be by random phone sample. So random digit dialing, samples of telephone area codes and exchanges are selected, and then random digits are added to the end to create a 10-digit phone number. The first step ensures phone numbers are distributed properly by geography. The second step, adding the random numbers, make sure that even unlisted numbers are included. This has traditionally been the standard practice by almost all public pollsters. Makes sense. This is how I thought it worked. The key then to accurately reflecting the diverse opinions of the general public is in the randomness of the surveyed group. This is explicitly not the case with Leo and Isay. These utilize non-probability samples, self-selected samples, which according to the American Association for Public Opinion Research, In self-selected or opt-in samples, respondents have selected themselves, and this means their answers may not be representative of the larger population. Types of self-selected samples include dial-in polls, popular with the media, and many internet-based polls. The American Association for Public Opinion Research cautions that results of surveys based on respondents who self-select may not be reliable. And they talk about this, like there's already a bias going into it. And then it gets worse when they start cherry-picking for each one, right? So they can go through this whole thing and crunch the data and figure out who they want to select for this next poll. Unfortunately for all of us, the problem with Leo and I say is even worse. People not only have to actively sign up for the service, which already introduces selection bias, that's what I was just mentioning, but they are then further selected for each survey by the company using whatever criteria they select. This is a surefire recipe for getting the answer that you want. This data is then used to influence the public by asserting that the majority hold a certain view. In a world of limited physical contact, no right to meet or protest, coupled with heavy internet censorship and absolute liberal government control of the mainstream media, you indeed have Orwell's nightmare. Don't forget, this is like September 2022, so 6 months after the convoy smackdown and all that. The average citizen has no way to know what the truth is. The real aim here is obvious, absolute control. The polls that tell you that Canadians want to destroy their own energy industry, that they don't want pipelines, and that everyone loves the dear leader Justin are generated in the exact same manner. The professional oversight for polling companies is laughably transparent. Ledger cites its adherence to the standards set by the Canadian Research and Insights Council, which in turn adheres to the global SOMAR network's standards. Jean-Marc Ledger is a founding member of CERC and on the Canadian representative of SOMAR. Pollsters, govern thyself. Now let's have a look at the Association for Canadian Studies. The About section of their website states, and it goes into all this, like, look at this, immigration, migration, immigration and settlement conference, social impacts network from COVID. The ACS's actual goals are far better described by one of their benefactors. ACS was granted $400,000 this year by one of the massive plethora of open borders NGOs, the World Education Service, who describes them thus. In a telephone interview, a spokesman for ACS stated that they get upwards of 70% of their funding from the Liberal government. So yeah, of course, because when you look at this, it is the Liberal government who funds all this. Let me go to my tab here on this. Actually, can I just do... Yeah, it's not this one. It is this one. Funding for Association for Canadian Studies. So it comes from the Canadian Studies Program of the Department of Canadian Heritage. So the Heritage one has like anywhere from 1.9 to 4 billion budget every year. But they fund all this kind of stuff, right? Multiculturalism, local journalism initiatives, Indigenous language and cultures, building communities through arts. And they fund Canada Media Fund, music funds, all this stuff, and they fund apparently that polling. They also have this anti-racism stuff. So, I mean, you know, you can just imagine that the government is funding this organization that pays for their polls to say what they want to say. I mean, when is enough enough, and how come this stuff is allowed to just continue on? It's just like what we're talking about with climate change, where the government funds the organization to give them the reports they want so they can send more money to all these other NGOs and perpetuate this net zero bullshit.
That's how they get you.
It's unbelievable. It's this circle jerk of corruption.
I like circle jocks. Circle jerks, I mean. All right, well, let's jump over to this quick. Here's your buddy Carney. Dude, he's got to say.
Reconcile Keaton Bill C-69 with your plans to build infrastructure in Canada. Do you plan to repeal Bill C-69?
We do not plan to repeal Bill C-69, to answer your question directly. What we have said and made very clear 10 days ago, formally with the First Minister's meeting, is that we will move for projects of national interest to remove duplication in terms of environmental assessments and other approvals. And we will follow, as the federal government, the principle of one project, one approval to move forward from that. And so what's essential is to work at this time of crisis to come together as a nation, all levels of government, to focus on those projects that are going to make material differences to our country, to Canadian workers, and to our future, and work closely together. And the federal government is looking to lead with that by saying, we will accept provincial environmental assessments to move forward with that for example, clean energy projects or conventional energy projects. There are many others that could be there. Last point, which in many respects is the first point, we will always ensure that these projects move forward in partnership
with First Nations, he says there. I don't know why that clip went to crap, but did it do it for you too, or is that just for me?
Yeah, it's for me too, yeah.
For you too. Okay, so that's Carney saying he won't repeal Bill C-69. Let's just go through some of that stuff that the highlights from B-Sil 69. So the Act expands assessments to include social, economic, gender-based, health, and climate change effects. That's nice. This allows for unbranded challenges and delays, as virtually any group can argue a project's impact on abstract concepts like gender equity or climate goals. The Minister of Environment has broad discretion. This is why they won't repeal 69. This is exactly why he says, oh, we might fast track this and that, but we won't repeal it, is because it gives the Minister of Environment, aka the federal government, broad powers to decide what gets assessed, intervene in the review process, and determine whether a project is public in the public interest. So it weakens the voices of the provinces, industry experts, and local stakeholders. Under Bill C-69, any person or group, regardless of proximity or expertise, can participate in reviews and launch legal challenges. Projects must account for Canada's climate commitments under the Paris Agreement, including life cycle emissions, not just local, but global.
Yeah.
This means even clean-burning LNG projects, which could reduce global emissions by displacing coal, can be denied if their net impact doesn't align with ideological climate targets.
And what if they're wrong? I mean, what if they're wrong about what's clean and what's not? I mean, we've seen this with the windmills already and solar and all this stuff that's supposed to be the best, and it's not turning out to be.
So even if a project is Indigenous-led, environmentally sound, and economically critical, Bill C-69 creates a gauntlet of unpredictable, ideological, and ever-expanding hurdles. It effectively hands veto power to federal politicians, activist groups, foreign interests, or bureaucrats with no stake in local prosperity. No investor wants to spend billions, only be denied by a shifting goalpost. So why is that important? Why is it? Because he's not going to repeal it, so he doesn't want to do any of this stuff in Canada. But we jump over to here. And this is from a while ago, but they just bought this pipeline here. This is because I think they closed on one in the States just at the end of last year as well for $10 billion. Here's another pipeline Brookfield bought for $13.5 billion. And then let's jump over. Now, I'm going to stop sharing this and start sharing this. So this is Brookfield's...
Brookfield.
I shared the wrong thing again. Okay, let's see. I need to share this window. Let's go through. Wait a second. Where'd it go?
I don't know.
It's not showing up here. Oh, there, now it is. Okay, so let's go to here then. So this is Brookfield Infrastructure Partners November 2022. Report. So this is the like shareholders report, I believe, the corporate profile shareholders report. What do you think we're going to find in here?
I don't know, that they're investing in oil and gas all over the world except for Canada.
I think that's probably a pretty safe bet. So let's come down here, do the agenda, blah blah blah, introduction to investment highlights. Okay, so here we are. Brookfield Infrastructure owns high-quality, long-life assets that provide essential products and services for essential. They're essential everywhere else, just not here. Essential products and services for the global economy. Utilities, 16.2 thousand kilometers, so that'd be about 10,000 miles of natural gas pipelines. 65,000 kilometers of operational electricity distribution and transmission lines, 7.7 million electricity and natural gas connections, 1.6 million smart meters installed, 32,000 kilometers of rail operations, 3,800 kilometers of toll roads, 15,000 kilometers of natural gas transmission pipelines, which is as much as they had everywhere else. I don't know if that's in addition to the other stuff. 600 billion cubic feet of natural gas storage. A lot of natural gas stuff here. You noticing that? You'd think they went all in on Canada's. But let's keep going. 17 natural gas and natural gas liquid processing plants and 3,400 kilometers of gas gathering pipelines. 3,300 kilometers of long-haul pipelines and 3,900 kilometers of conventional pipelines. And 165,000 operational telecom towers and active rooftop sites. That'd be all your cell stuff. 268,000 kilometers of fiber optic cable. All sorts of cool stuff.
Well, hang on. Go back to that graph there.
This one, that's just
their No, the other one. That one, yeah.
So, yeah, that's their... for stock growth, I think.
Okay.
Let's go down to here. So private investors are essential in addressing the global infrastructure funding gap. Historically, governments and utility companies provided most of this infrastructure. So we don't need to get into that. Let's go down here a little bit more. So ESG, environmental and social governance principles at Brookfield. One is mitigate the impact of our operations on the environment. So let's go down on how they're doing that in action. I want to start with this one right over here, because we did that slash and sell story about them being in court for slave labor and destroying a couple thousand acres of Amazon rainforest. But it here says on the report that they're actually working to restore more than 1,000 hectares of rainforest in Brazil, not destroying it, with 554 I'm done to date. So,
well, yeah, you have to destroy it to rebuild it, right? So, I mean,
they recently announced a partnership with the Intel Corporation to build a $30 billion semiconductor foundry in Arizona.
Wow.
Yeah, well, we're threatening to stop sending semiconductors right now from Canada. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, his company is building a semiconductor factory. I mean, it would make sense that you wouldn't want Canadian companies competing with your Brookfield in their new factory to build semiconductors down in Arizona. Just saying. Comes across as kind of sketchy, right?
No wonder why he doesn't want to talk about his conflicts of interest.
Exactly. They just acquired another 36,000 telecom towers in Germany and Austria. Announced their intention to acquire and privatize HomeServe, a provider of subscription-based recurring home repair policies for homeowners in North America and Europe.
Oh boy, that sounds super sketchy.
It don't sound good. So the 3 Ds, digitalization, invest in opportunities derived from exponential increase in data consumption, decarbonization, utility or residential energy infrastructure investments, reduce or eliminate emissions, and support the reshoring. Deglobalization supports the reshoring of essential and strategic manufacturing processes and supply trades. So this just kind of goes through. They got 4,200 kilometers of natural gas pipelines in North America, South America, and India, 5,300 kilometers of transmission lines in Brazil, 61,000 kilometers of electricity distribution. There's the smart meters again. Smart meters, diversified terminals, 30 million tons per annum of LNG export terminal in the U.S., and 85 million tons per annum of an exported out of Australia. I mean, Brookfield is exporting all sorts of...
But not Canada. But why not Canada?
But not Canada. So 15,000 kilometers of transmission pipelines in the U.S., 600 billion cubic feet of natural gas storage in the U.S. and Canada, gas gathering pipelines in the U.S. and Canada, and conventional pipelines. 154,000 telecom towers in India, 8,000 towers and active rooftop sites in France, 1,600 cell sites in New Zealand, 2,100 active telecom towers. I mean, these guys are globalization. It's crazy. Oh,
they said they were deglobalizing, though.
2,100 telecom towers and distributed antenna systems in the UK and 246,000 fiber to premise connections in Australia. They're deglobalizing like crazy. Okay. So that aside, why does that matter? So, I mean, you know who else makes a bunch of natural gas? Oh, no, I didn't switch it fast enough.
Who else?
Qatar. Qatar is a significant competitor to Canada in the global liquefied natural gas market. Qatar has been a leading LNG exporter and is undertaking substantial expansion plans to increase its production capacity. The North Field Expansion Project aims to boost Qatar's LNG production to 142 million tons per annum by 2030, potentially capturing nearly 25% of the global market share. Canada is also working to blah, blah, blah. In summary, Qatar's aggressive LNG expansion positions it as a formal competitor to Canada's emerging LNG industry. The Qatar Investment Authority, Qatar's sovereign wealth fund, has established a significant partnership with Brookfield Asset Management, a global investment firm through various collaborative ventures. The Manhattan West Development, QIA, acquired a 44% stake in Brookfield's $8.6 billion Manhattan West mixed-use development project in New York City. Canary Wharf Program, QIA and Brookfield jointly took control of London's Canary Wharf Group in April 2015 by acquiring Songbird Estates PLC, which owns 69% of Canary Wharf Group. One Manhattan West, March 2022, Brookfield and QIA sold a 49% stake in One Manhattan West, a 67-story office tower in New York. The transaction valued the building at $2.85 billion. In December 2014, QIA made a strategic investment of $1.8 billion in Brookfield Property Partners through the purchase of exchangeable preferred equity securities.
Oh, interesting.
The investment provided QIA with a significant stake in Brookfield's real estate operations. In October 2015, QIA, alongside China Life Insurance Company, acquired an 80% stake in 99 Bishop Gate from Brookfield Property Partners. There's the Wharf one again.
Okay. Can I bring Trump into this?
Yeah, I'm gonna bring Trump in yet. I'm still gonna bring that in.
I have a bunch of bullets that I could share that fit right into what you're talking about.
Well, let me finish first. QIA has billions invested in Brookfield, including co-ownership of major global real estate projects and a significant historical stake in Brookfield Property Partners. If Brookfield is still leveraging Qatari capital or aligning future deals with QIA, it would be against their shared financial interest to have Canadian LNG undercutting Qatar's dominance. Canada's West Coast LNG could reach Asian markets faster and cheaper than shipments from the Persian Gulf. This is especially threatening to Qatar, as China, Japan, and South Korea would likely seek long-term contracts. Brookfield is not a nationalist Canadian firm. It is a global investment powerhouse. Its leadership, including figures like Mark Carney, a former central banker with globalist leanings, is more interested in maximizing global returns, not advancing Canadian sovereignty or energy independence. If the political class blocks or delays Canadian LNG, Brookfield's international investments, like in Qatar or the US, could stand to benefit from less competition and more stable demand for existing assets. So then we could jump over to here, which I think is at the top of this. I think I've actually got it at the top of this. So this is the, because everyone's wondering, why is Trump, seems like Trump's trying to get Carney elected, right? It seems like so. Why could that be? Well, let's jump over here. Okay, 666 Fifth Avenue lease agreement. In August 2018, Brookfield acquired a 99-year lease on 666 Fifth Avenue, a Manhattan skyscraper owned by Kushner Companies, the family business of Jared Kushner. Brookfield paid approximately $1.1 billion upfront for the lease, allowing Kushner Companies to pay off substantial debts associated with the property. This deal attracted attention because the Qatar Investment Authority, QIA, Qatar's sovereign wealth fund, was a significant investor in Brookfield. The QIA held a substantial stake in Brookfield Property Partners and the subsidiary involved in the transaction. Both Brookfield and QIA stated the QIA had no involvement in the Fifth Avenue deal. The U.S. Senate Finance Committee, led by Senator Ron Wyden, initiated an investigation into whether Jared Kushner's financial interests influenced U.S. foreign policy, particularly concerning the blockade of Qatar by other Gulf nations. In 2015, Jared Kushner purchased the six floors of the building at 229 West 43rd Street in Manhattan for $295 million. Nearly the entire purchase price was financed through loans from the Brookfield Asset Management. Kushner's plan was to lease the space to various entertainment venues to create an attraction near Times Square. This arrangement highlighted another financial connection between Kushner and Brookfield. So, it seems like
Trump. And so Kushner is Ivanka's husband, right?
Kushner is Trump's son-in-law, yes.
Yes, just so everybody remembers the connection there. And did that talk about it, them paying for the 100-year lease up front, which is very rare and yeah, kind
exactly.
of
exactly. Exactly. To get I'm sharing the links in the wrong
So should I interject with mine now, which just sort of put, we'll put a bit of a different spin on that, or
yeah, well, I have a clip I can play too, but why don't you go first? Why don't we get you
okay, so this is just like from Trisha Wood. She was talking about how this is kind of coming in hot and she can't wait on it any longer. Carney Trump loving looks dirty as hell. Editorial note, political trolls on social media, blah blah blah, trying to discredit the story. We say in caps in the story below, but as well with propaganda, the lie is in the twist. I've shortened it to fit the SS format better and fix some typos. So here it's complex and I'm giving these short points up front so there's no confusion. Also, to be fair to all concerned. So here it is. Brookfield brokered a deal with the sitting president's son that includes money from country that is in play diplomatically in the Middle East. That deal has been massively controversial for Trump and Kushner, given that Kushner was running ME foreign policy for his father-in-law, so receiving a $1 billion bailout from a country in that portfolio is not a good look. To learn more, don't Google Carney and Kushner, Google Qatar and Kushner. There are dozens of stories and some investigations about this iffy deal. How does Carney fit in if he came later? Because Carney came into Brookfield, I think, in 2020 or 2022, right? Do you remember?
I think 2020.
Later is when all the questions began being raised. A U.S. Finance Committee looked into it and other bad press happened while Carney was at Brookfield. The letter from the FC went to the Toronto office begging for information and decrying the fact Brookfield seemed to be stonewalling. Again, Carney was there for that and would be negligent to not have read the file to understand what his company was involved in. The point is, Carney would likely know all about what happened. Here's where we are now. Two men, one of them president, whose family owes Brookfield a huge debt of gratitude, is oddly praising a foreign leader, Carney, who's been threatening him. Carney, who was around when the Kushner deal was exposed as a Qatari venture, in part, would have seen things in those files that could hurt the president's family and perhaps even Brookfield if made public. Leveraged against each other is still a conflict of interest. It means we can't be confident of interactions between Trump and Carney that are strictly in the interests of this country. Simply, would Trump help Carney win to keep him happy? How will Carney deal with what he knows about the Trump family? You'll note some people say not Qatari money because Apollo invested, except Apollo is Qatari money. I hope this helps. Off to pack for Ottawa. And then there's a Newsweek story here. There's some backup information. Now, I want to go to this as well because this can just sort of add another twist to it. Have you seen this article at all from the Sean Newman podcast?
Not sure.
Two powerful men secretly orchestrated Canada's financial destiny for over a decade. So this will kind of blow you away, but there is an intersection here that fits in with what you're talking about. One was caught in a massive money laundering scandal. The other just became prime minister. No one's talking about their connection until now. So Frank McKenna, TD's bank deputy chair since 2006, Mark Carney, former Bank of England governor, and we all know as well, Goldman Sachs and Bank of Canada. One stayed in boardrooms, the other now controls Canada's government, but they intersected at one crucial point that changed everything: Brookfield Asset Management. October 2024, TD Bank pleads guilty to money laundering, $3.1 billion in fines. So this is not too long ago, right? Like 5-6 months ago, where that other guy came from, right? While he was running it, they pled guilty.
That was the biggest fine in history.
The bank admitted helping drug cartels move dirty money for nearly a decade, all while McKenna was deputy chair, a position with direct oversight of bank risk and compliance. How does a deputy chair, one of the most senior positions, remain unaware of a decade-long criminal activity within his own bank? It's hard to imagine McKenna, a former premier and ambassador, didn't know something what was happening. But the story gets more interesting. Meanwhile, in 2020, yes, Mark Carney joins Brookfield Asset Management. Who's been chairman of Brookfield's board since 2010? Frank McKenna. The same TD Bank executive whose bank just got caught money laundering. Coincidence? Let's dig deeper. At Brookfield, McKenna and Carney formed a powerful alliance. McKenna, the board gatekeeper. Carney, the visionary pushing billions into green investments. Together, they reshaped one of the world's largest asset managers while cultivating political influence. There's a good picture of him right there. Think about this timeline. TD Bank laundering money during McKenna's watch. McKenna brings Carney to Brookfield. Carney becomes chair of Brookfield. Carney suddenly leaves to run for prime minister. McKenna publicly endorses him. Pieces, puzzle pieces start connecting. Carney's rise to prime minister in March 2025 seemed meteoric to most Canadians. But was it really? Or was it the culmination of years of careful positioning with McKenna pulling the strings from corporate boardrooms? The question we should be asking, did McKenna know about TD's money laundering? Was Carney's position at Brookfield a strategic stepping stone? Who really benefits from having a former central banker as PM? Why did Carney leave Brookfield so abruptly? So I think that's pretty good rundown there.
Yeah.
Hang on, one more thing. And their biggest shared agenda? The green, actually, let me just back up here. Consider the unprecedented access these two now have. McKenna connected to TD Bank and Brookfield, Carney running Canada's government, a former banker and central banker now control both corporate policy and government policy. And their biggest shared agenda, the green transition, redirecting trillions from traditional industries into new sustainable investments, funds that Brookfield is perfectly positioned to manage. Let's not forget, I don't want to go any further than that. I mean, that's a pretty good rundown, though. But, I mean, to be honest with you, this whole green sort of money laundering thing is falling apart, with Trump and the USAID thing. Like, that's why I think that the USA is the only bulwark against this globalist sort of climate cartel. So how is that going to interact with Trump and Carney, like, and their past relationship? Because Trump seems to be dismantling it. Unless it's all virtue signaling, but I don't think it is. I mean, they're really cutting, it's too late to go back and change it now that Elon and him have sort of uprooted this whole NGO funding web of corruption. So I don't know. How is Trump and Carney going to handle this? Like, what if like, that's why Carney's in there? Like, what if, because otherwise Trump could dismantle it, but because Carney and Trump had this problem with the Kushner thing and all that, right? I mean, maybe that's one of the reasons why he's in there, because then that protects the globalist network from being attacked by Trump.
Yeah.
Mind you, we kind of knew that Carney was, I mean, I think we all knew. I mean, they talked about it back. Oh, here's a clip. I mean, I've got another clip I should play that if just to highlight what we're going to be dealing with if he wins. Okay, quick one here.
We'll be dealing with this with the breakup of Canada.
Thousands of truck drivers have descended on Ottawa, the
capital
city,
it?
To protest.
Yeah, this is my clip. I put this on my Instagram.
Really? Should I play it then? Or
the problem is that half the people that don't agree with us agree with this.
Yeah.
You might as well play it.
Okay.
Government.
Justin Trudeau. So this is going back to the convoy, and Carney makes an appearance.
Trudeau does not like truck drivers. He thinks they're revolting. Justin Trudeau likes private equity barons and tech moguls and other people who give him money. Trudeau is not in Ottawa right now. In fact, he and his family fled when the truck drivers arrived, and they've been in hiding ever since. So when the revolution he has been calling for finally arrived, Justin Trudeau wasn't there to see it. He ran away in terror. Kind of sad. So instead, in his place, his friend Mark Carney has been speaking for him. Carney is a former Goldman Sachs executive who many believe will replace Justin Trudeau if Trudeau ever decides to give up power. In a recent op-ed, Mark Carney vented his rage at the impudent truckers in Ottawa and anyone who sent them money on the internet. Quote, "Anyone sending money to the convoy should be in no doubt," Carney wrote. "You are funding sedition. Foreign funders of an insurrection interfered in our domestic affairs from the start." Got that? It's not a protest. It's sedition. It's an insurrection. Clearly, Mark Carney's been watching a lot of CNN up there in Canada. And that's why he's concluded the truckers should be crushed by force. Quote.
I don't like that. I don't like how Tucker used crushed by force. He didn't say that. He said by the full force of the law, which is different than, you know, by force. He sounds like he's saying he wanted physical force.
Those who are still helping to extend this occupation must be identified and punished to the full force of the law. People who sent the money should be prosecuted. If they're not prosecuted, Mark Carney fears, quote, "the constant blaring of horns at all hours will bankrupt our businesses." Are you laughing yet? So the very same finance ghouls who cheered lockdowns for two solid years are now deeply concerned that small businesses might be hurt by the trucker protests. Hilarious. It'd be interesting, by the way, to poll small business owners in Ottawa to see what they think. How do they feel about the truckers? Somehow you know exactly what those results would be, but no one's doing that poll, of course. Instead, they found an easier way. Justin Trudeau has just ordered police to shut the whole thing down. How do you do that? How do you stop a truck protest? Simple. You seize their fuel. That's exactly what police in Canada are doing.
There you go. All right. Thanks. Back to you.
I don't know if we need to play this clip.
Yeah, yeah. Play the one you had lined up.
All right, yeah, I'll play it. I've never really listened to this guy or this clip, so let's hope it's not a total train wreck.
Going in cold.
And Brookfield Asset Management. And is this why Trump appears to be backing Carney for Prime Minister of Canada? Let's look at the facts. In 2018, Brookfield Asset Management signed a 99-year lease.
This is from Blender News, B-L-E-N-D-R.
For 666 Fifth Avenue, a Manhattan office tower owned by Jared Kushner's family real estate firm, Kushner Companies. The deal, worth $1.1 billion, was paid up front, which is highly unusual, if not unprecedented, in these types of transactions. However, at the time, Kushner Companies was struggling with $1.2 billion in debt, so this deal effectively bailed them out. For those who don't know, Jared Kushner is the son-in-law of Donald Trump and served as a senior advisor in Trump's first administration from 2017 to 2021. He played a significant role in Middle East diplomacy and was instrumental in brokering the Abraham Accords, which normalized relations between Israel and several Arab nations. Okay, back to the $1.1 billion 99-year lease. The unusual nature of this deal gets even more bizarre when you realize that Brookfield's largest investor is the Qatar Investment Authority, or the QIA, a sovereign wealth fund controlled by the Qatari government. Given Kushner's position in the Trump administration and his involvement in Middle East diplomacy, this deal now raises red flags about political influence. However, when the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives began investigating the transaction, Brookfield denied any political influence, claiming that the QIA was a passive investor, although some reports suggested otherwise. And because some reports suggested otherwise, I dug a little deeper. Here's what I found. Right before Trump took office, Kushner Companies sought funding directly from Qatar's QIA for 666 Fifth Avenue, but the request was denied. Shortly after, in June of 2017, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and others launched a blockade against Qatar, accusing it of supporting terrorism. The Trump administration backed the blockade, aligning with Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Some reports even suggest that Kushner may have actively opposed U.S. efforts to mediate the crisis, which would have increased pressure on Qatar. Then, all of a sudden, the Trump administration shifted its stance and became more conciliatory toward Qatar. In April 2018, Trump hosted Qatar's emir at the White House, reversing his position on the blockade. By June 2018, Qatar's sovereign wealth fund announced a significant increase in investments in the U.S. And then just a few short months later, in August of 2018, Brookfield, holding billions of Qatar's investment dollars, signed the 99-year lease for 666 Fifth Avenue, rescuing Kushner Companies from its financial troubles. While there's no concrete proof that Kushner or Trump used U.S. policy as leverage, this sequence of events is highly suspect. To me, it looks like Kushner was losing his shirt, the Qataris were not interested in helping him out. Then through political leverage, they had no choice but to play ball, where Brookfield Asset Management was used as a proxy to to avoid a direct conflict of interest. Again, this is just my assessment of the facts. Okay, so Brookfield bails out Trump's son-in-law with an unprecedented deal while he was serving the administration. The connection here is quite clear. Now that we know Brookfield has direct ties to Trump, I thought it would be important to understand how deeply embedded they were in the U.S. economy. Here's what I found. Brookfield has significant investments in the United States, spanning real estate, infrastructure, renewable energy, and private equity. Their notable real estate includes 666 Fifth Avenue, the Kushner bailout deal, Manhattan West in New York, a $4.5 billion development completed in 2021, featuring 7 million square feet of mixed-use space, and 135 mobile parks in 13 states, consolidating ownership in this sector. As for infrastructure and energy, Brookfield operates 33,000 megawatts of capacity in the U.S. from renewable energy sources. They acquired a significant stake in Westinghouse Electric Company, a nuclear energy provider, for $4.6 billion. Brookfield also owns stakes in U.S. energy infrastructure, including pipelines and storage facilities, supporting fossil fuels alongside renewable energy. In total, Brookfield manages over $1 trillion in assets globally, with the U.S. accounting for roughly half, or $500 billion of its portfolio. So it's safe to say Brookfield is an asset of interest to the U.S. government. All right, now let's jump into Mark Carney. First, when did Carney join Brookfield? Unlike some reports suggest, Mark Carney was not involved in Brookfield when the Kushner deal was closed. He joined Brookfield Asset Management as vice chair and head of ESG transition investing in August of 2020 after leaving the Bank of England. Then in April 2022, Carney became chairman of the board for Brookfield Asset Management. Now, if you're looking for a recent move by Carney that might have garnered favor with Trump, we can just look to Brookfield officially moving their headquarters out of Canada and into New York. The board, chaired by Carney, unanimously approved the move in late 2024. Carney then signed a letter to shareholders on December 1st, 2024, urging them to vote for reorganization. Now, for some unknown reason, he lied about this, but this was exposed by the Conservative Party shortly after. Carney resigned from Brookfield on January 15th, 2025 to run in the Liberal leadership race before the shareholder vote finalized the process, though the operational shift was already underway and, of course, it passed. However, despite Carney exiting the company, it's crucial to note that he maintains as much as $50 million in deferred shares and stock options in Brookfield. So, now for the big question. Is it feasible that Trump is supporting Carney because of past and potentially future business? Let's do a quick recap to assess the feasibility. The 2018 Kushner bailout tied Brookfield to Trump's inner circle during his presidency. As a result, Trump likely used Brookfield and, by extension, Carney, as having supported his family interests, because they did. The decision to move Brookfield's headquarters to New York in 2024, shortly after Trump's re-election, aligns with his calls for companies to relocate to the U.S. This move could easily be seen as a win for Trump's economic agenda, making Carney more appealing in Trump's eyes. Brookfield's substantial U.S. investments, particularly in infrastructure and energy, resonate with Trump's policy goals, as Prime Minister Carney could facilitate cross-border deals that benefit both Brookfield and U.S. interests, such as joint energy projects or trade agreements designed to soften the impacts of tariffs. On the topic of tariffs, a Carney-led government viewed as business-friendly to the U.S. would be more appealing to Trump than an adversarial leader like Pierre Poilievre. This might explain why some independent media outlets are now suggesting that Carney could quietly fold to Trump's tariff demands once he's in office. And of course, Trump values loyalty and deal-making, and Carney's leadership at Brookfield may signal to Trump that Carney is a pragmatic leader who prioritizes economic ties over nationalist resistance. Carney is a globalist after all. Trump also recently praised Mark Carney as Canada's prime minister, not the governor of the 51st state. Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean, it's pretty hard. It's pretty damning.
It's a pretty good rundown. I mean, I just can't get out of my mind that the Trump and Carney should be the exact opposites. I mean, Trump sort of exiting from all these Paris Accords and all this IPCC bullshit, and Carney like sort of like one of the head globalists, like basically the big boss of climate corruption, you know? And
it's the new globalists. So.
Is it all just like smoke and mirrors? I mean, where is it like deal making versus corruption? Like, it really seems like, well, some of that could just be deal making, but some of it sounds like corruption, you know? Is it the same as sort of the Biden Hunter corruption? Like, is it not the same, but is it any worse than that? Is it any better than that? You know, it's really, there's such a commingling of corporations and government now. What?
It's just different. It doesn't have to be better or worse. It's just different. It's just new fucking goons in charge.
No. Because if some is regime change versus like energy infrastructure, it's different. You know.
I mean, here's the thing. It makes it seem like Carney would be here to manage the merger of Canada and the U.S. even more so.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm wondering.
Which could start with winning the election to push Alberta out, and then you've got the rest of Canada is just on a fucking, basically just like a wick is burning until they're forced economically to join, you know? It's really starting to think like Carney's here to manage the breakup of Canada just like he managed the breakup of the EU.
With
Brexit, yeah, he managed the Brexit. He was, well, he wasn't like, because he couldn't be in the
politics,
but it was, it's a breakup of the EU in a certain extent. They were leaving the EU. And he managed it through the bank. And then joined some, owned some globalist company, this crazy globalist company that, I mean, clearly cares not about borders. I mean,
or climate change. I mean, as much as you think. I mean, really, like the amount of. I mean, I know they're investing.
You have to add the caveat to that that you can't, like, that's not Carney. That fact that they own all that stuff, and it looks like the role that he came in to do was a little more based on that kind of stuff. But I mean, from my side, it just seems like okay. So it really starts to seem like he's just here to manage the merger. Manage the merger. So, okay, I'm going to finish with this one. This is from our buddies over at the Bureau. Which is, what's his name again?
Is this that, like, what do you call it when you have a bounty? Is this the Bounty Gate thing?
Sam Cooper. No, this ain't Bounty Gate. This is from 2021. Coordinated and alarming allegations of Chinese voter suppression in the 2021 race that flipped the Toronto riding to the Liberals and Paul Chiang. I don't know what it'll say about Paul Chiang. As Canada's snap election unfolds under the shadow of foreign interference, following the resignation of a Liberal MP accused of suggesting his conservative rival could be handed to the Chinese officials for a bounty, the Bureau has uncovered new allegations that Chinese agents attempted to intimidate voters and the conservative incumbent in the same Markham Unionville riding during the 2021 federal campaign. These revelations raise urgent concerns that similar tactics may be resurfacing in Toronto area ridings with large communities of immigrants from China and Hong Kong. Paul Chiang, a former police officer who unseated longtime conservative representative Bob Soroya to win Markham Unionville for Team Trudeau in 2021, stepped down as a candidate late Monday after the RCMP confirmed it was reviewing remarks he made to Chinese language media in January. During that event, Chiang reportedly said Conservative candidate Joe Tay, a Canadian citizen wanted under Hong Kong's national security law, could, now both these guys are born in Hong Kong, which is a problem already, you know, that they're in our government. A Canadian citizen, they can come here, they can do here, they can do well, but they should not be affecting policy, could be taken to the Chinese consulate to claim the bounty. Tay, a former Hong Kong broadcaster whose independent reporting from Canada has drawn retaliation from Beijing, rejected Chiang's apology, calling his comments to Chinese language journalists the tradecraft of the Chinese Communist Party. He added, they are not just aimed at me, they are intended to send a chilling signal to the entire community to force compliance with Beijing's political goals. His concerns were echoed by dozens of NGOs and human rights organizations, which condemned Chiang's remarks as an endorsement of transnational suppression. There is no indication Chiang was aware of the intimidation campaign.
Repression. So this is the Bounty Gate, then, isn't it, or no?
It is the Bounty Gate. Yeah, but it's going to go back to some other stuff.
Going back a ways, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I noticed that transnational repression in there, you know, instead of like...
Yeah, well, basically he's saying... It's popping the lid on what they've been doing to actual people, not the politicians that the CCP is putting on all these people we've brought over. They're basically saying, you know, toe the line. We need the Liberals in power.
Did you hear the clip, the bounty clip?
Yeah, it sounded like he was joking.
I know. Am I the only one? I'm glad you said that. I'm like, am I the only one that really just doesn't think there's a big deal there? Like,
I mean, the thing is, you can't make that joke. You can't make that joke when you're
Wasn't he saying there's already a bounty on the guy's head, and that, like,
yeah, there was a bounty. That's what he was saying. So he basically
was advertising the bounty. But I mean, am I the only one that thinks that's not really that big of a deal? Like, And I mean, it's even, it's not even the party that I like.
But politics. It shouldn't be in our politics. It shouldn't be an issue in our politics because we shouldn't have people born in other countries in our government.
100%. I mean, if I ever went to another government, I mean, if I went anywhere, I would never expect to be allowed to run in the government.
I'm going to move to the States.
I went to another country.
There's no indication Chang was aware of the intimidation campaign alleged by senior conservative sources during the 2021 vote. He has described his January remarks as ill-considered joke, a serious lapse in judgment, and emphasized that he intended no harm or wrongdoing. According to multiple senior figures from Aaron O'Toole's 2021 conservative campaign, who spoke on condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of intelligence disclosures, O'Toole's team was briefed by Canadian intelligence that Chinese officials were actively surveilling Soroya during the election. One source recalled being told that there were Chinese officials following Bob Soroya around and that CSIS literally said repeatedly that this was coordinated and alarming. Bob lost because the Chinese vote abandoned him, the source added. When asked to respond, O'Toole, who stepped down after the 2021 loss, acknowledged awareness of voter intimidation reports, but did not say whether CSIS had informed his team about alleged Chinese surveillance targeting Soroya. Our candidate, Bob Soroya, was a hardworking MP who won against the Liberal wave in 2015, O'Toole wrote. He won in 2019 as well, but thousands of votes from the Chinese-Canadian community stayed home in 2021. We heard reports of intimidation of voters. We also know that the Consul General from China...
Hang on. Did you hear that press conference today about intimidation and voting?
No.
Did you hear that? Oh my God! They did a land acknowledgement, and then she said, "Do not be intimidated by voting. Like, go to a safe place and make a phone call to the cops, and we will take care of it. You should feel safe to vote. Nobody will know who you vote for. This is why they're saying that now."
Bingo mango.
I mean, should I find the clip or is it crazy to build on this even more?
You can find it quick.
All right. Okay. Keep going. This is awesome.
A third senior conservative campaign source confirmed Chinese interference was a concern in multiple ridings. The concern was related to China. We had candidates that were being intimidated, the source said. Speaking specifically to Soroya's campaign, the source said that in the early stages of the 2021 election, Soroya and a close family member believed they were performing well. He said he had never had such a good reaction at the doors, and he assumed he was getting the Chinese traditional vote. But the campaign later learned from CSIS that Soroya was allegedly being followed by suspected Chinese security personnel. Remember, think about the Chinese police stations. Intelligence assessments reportedly indicated that these actors were shadowing Soroya's canvassing team and visiting the same home shortly after campaign stops. While the Bureau has not confirmed CSIS's exact conclusions, the conduct appears consistent with voter suppression tactics paralleling public warnings issued this week by Canada's SITE site task force, which is probably where your clip's going to come from. The source added that CSIS interviewed Soroya. He was convinced he was being tailed at times. They said the Bureau has independently confirmed with two sources that Soroya was interviewed by CSIS. Soroya has declined to comment. No kidding. While Soroya has not named among the alleged victims in January 2022, a special report from the Privy Council Office, sourced from over 100 CSIS documents and reviewed by the Bureau, stated that a small number of MPs in 2021 reported concerns for their families, reputations, privacy, and re-election challenges due to targeted CCP activity. Another section of the report details threats and coercion strongly resembling the emerging picture in Markham. It stated that Chinese diplomats, public security officers, and intelligence officers had monitored Canadians, think police stations again, including one case in which agents threatened the parents of a student in Canada. The Privy Council Office report also suggested that concerns about forced repatriations or even covert renditions, dragging them back to China, of dissidents are plausible. It noted that in 2020, a Chinese police liaison worked with the Canadian law enforcement officer to repatriate an economic fugitive in the Fox Hunt campaign. Another coerced repatriation involved Chinese police bringing a fugitive's brother and father to Canada, and the relatives could not return to China unless the fugitive returned with them. The report also noted that Chinese intelligence officers have discussed that Canadians can be messed with in person and online because they're critical of China. Although site officials have not directly addressed Zhou Tay's statement that he contacted the RCMP for protection in relation to his candidacy, they acknowledged under repeated questioning from the Canadian reporters Monday that the spread of Chang's comments through Chinese language media fits a broader pattern of foreign interference aimed at silencing dissidents and influencing voters. In a public statement, a site official said the task force is aware of ongoing efforts by authoritarian regimes to target dissidents, critics, journalists, and other members of the diaspora communities, diaspora. Please remember two things. First, your vote is secret and secure. Well, now I'll skip that because you're going to play the clip. Let's go down to the bottom. I think this is the unit. Even after Chang's resignation, Prime Minister Mark Carney has faced renewed scrutiny for expressing confidence in him. Just hours before the RCMP announced its investigation, Carney characterized the controversy as a teachable moment.
And I mean, I'm not going to have a popular opinion on this either, but I mean, it's about time a politician actually just apologized and said it was a teachable moment. Like, he acknowledged it. And, you know, like, to me, like, okay, what was wrong with that? Like, he didn't have to fire him right away, did he? I mean, everybody's losing it because he didn't.
Well, what happened to elbows up? I mean, what if it was an American?
What do you mean?
What if it was like the American influence sort of campaign here? I mean, we've ended our longstanding relationship with America for less.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying I liked his response. That's all. I mean, I'm just not going to be like, I'm not going to like hate on everything I hear from Carney. If I like some of his responses, I'm going to say it. That's all.
Carney has continually said next to nothing on China. He added, it's one of the most significant political and geopolitical issues of our time, and he has nothing to say. Why? China is a major concern for the United States, and yet he remains silent, even after the execution of four Canadians, which we didn't talk about on the show, and right, he hasn't talked about either. The Durham Regional Police Association, which represents officers in one of the three Ontario forces where Chang served, issued a statement condemning Carney's actions. We are disappointed in the clear lack of integrity and leadership displayed by Mark Carney to stand by this candidate rather than act after such egregious actions, the association wrote, adding that Chang's conduct would be held to a higher standard for an active officer in Ontario. The group also rejected Carney's defense of Chang's law enforcement background. The fact that Mr. Carney used Chang's policing career as a shield for his actions undermines the great work our heroes in uniforms do in their communities each and every day. Chang's policing career spanned nearly 30 years. He began with the London Police Service in 1992, and then blah, 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 blah. That was a long one.
Oh, and he worked in the diversity unit in the end there, which is kind of weird. He ended up in a DEI position.
Diversity officer, yeah, in the cultural resources unit.
Of course, right? So, okay, here we go. I mean, this is from Viva Fry. Just watched it before the show tonight. Hopefully you can you hear that?
We've existed for times immemorial for long times.
Isn't it time immemorial?
Yeah. I just skipped by the land acknowledgement. Sorry, but I mean, it was inadvertent. But
je vous invite à prendre quelques instants pour reconnaître l'importance des terres sur lesquelles vous vivez.
I would invite you to take a few seconds to think about the importance of the lands on which you live. I just want to play it again from the beginning.
Oh, no,
this
no.
Is what happens
when no,
you.
No, no.
Do the natives have to thank
you from the traditional unceded
residential schools? Logically, but they've taken
up. No.
We've made sense when doing it. Are they going to go after the left? No. People make a joke.
The strength of Canadian society is for all.
Okay, here we go.
Listen to this and understand what it is.
The strength of Canadian society is for all of its citizens to be able to freely and safely participate in our democratic processes. Internationally, Canada is working with our partners and allies to address this pressing global threat. As part of Canada's 2025 presidency, G7 members will come together to discuss a coordinated response to countering transnational repression. Here at home, we are taking a whole-of-society approach. Canada's security and intelligence organizations are at the front line of efforts to detect and counter this threat. To all Canadians, if someone pressures you or threatens you to vote in a certain way, please remember two things. First, your vote is secret and secure. They will not be able to find out who you vote for.
Unless you get hacked and leaked.
It is an offense to threaten someone so that they change their vote.
Stop. Can you imagine having to reassure people who vote that their vote is confidential?
So, I mean, this is... when you read that thing, right, it was talking about they said a whole bunch of people just stayed home that one time, right? Was that a bunch of liberal voters?
It was a bunch of conservative Chinese people.
Conservative voters. Interesting.
First of all, it's paper in Canada. At least it was federally. I thought this announcement was going to be, we're going to Dominion voting machines because it's too dangerous to vote on paper. No. It's illegal to threaten someone to change their vote. Thank you. Thank you for stating the obvious. Can you remind me again that you're thanking people for being on native territory?
As soon as it is safe, write down details about the situation.
Stop, I'm sorry.
Or threatens you to vote in a certain way, please remember two things. First, your vote is secret and secure. They will not be able to find out who you vote for. And second, it is an offense to threaten someone so that they change their vote.
What should you do? Go take notes. Take notes. Write them all.
As soon as it is safe.
As soon as it's
write
safe.
Write down details about.
As soon as it
okay.
is safe.
Someone right. said, I don't know. I don't know if we want to keep getting people to interrupt this. But anyway, she goes on to say, like, we're handling this with, you know, like the cops and the
police
people
in your area. You can also contact the RCMP National Security Information Network to report non-immediate threats.
So they're saying, like, they're giving you who to report it to and that we take it seriously. We'll take, and I'm thinking, man, they don't even take like violent crime seriously anymore in Canada, but don't be intimidated to vote the wrong way.
That's right. All right. Should we get out of here?
I guess so. I mean, that was a good one.
Yeah, it's been an hour and a half. It's about time to get out. I think we're going to get monetized on YouTube soon. It's looking like if you're watching on the A-List YouTube channel, so you'll be able to super chat us and stuff there hopefully soon or be a member. I don't know what that's going to look like. It's been a long time since we've done something like this, so we'll see. But that's exciting. So like and subscribe on YouTube if you're doing that. If you're watching on Outlawed, of course, head over and sign up at GrowAmericaOutlawed.ca. And for the A-List people, if you're just watching on the A-List, we are just value for value. So just head over to A-List, just like it is behind Graham there, a-list.ca. And there's a button there on you can support us for whatever you want. Just click on the button and do what you want and send us a note. And we'd love that. That'd be great. That's how we keep doing this. Obviously, with this kind of content, we're never going to be allowed to, you know, do much commercials or anything like that. Or we don't want to be have to watch what we say or have any sort of outside influence other than our listeners. So alist.ca. And you can support us and we'll keep doing what we're doing. Other than that, like, subscribe, share the content. We check out grandamerica.ca for our other shows, adultbrain.ca for audiobooks, contact@thecabin.com for trips and events, and adultbrain.ca. We got a bunch of audiobooks and ebooks and everything else over there. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
Who's going to kill this sacred cow? You were never political anyhow. Since when did you start trusting in the government? Since when was it okay to ridicule and shame your neighbor? Your opinions have become as fickle as artificial flavors. What matters most to you? What the TV host told you to do? Or a moral compass that points true north, oh true. Who's gonna kill this sacred cow? You were never religious anyhow. Since when did you kiss the ring on the hand of the Pope? Since when do we need pharmaceuticals to cope? Your soul has become, ever-loving soul has become, as brittle as communion wafers. What matters most to you? What the Holy Ghost told you to do? Or a moral compass that points true north, oh true. I'm gonna kill this sacred cow. Bureaucrats think I'm non-essential anyhow. Since when has our culture become so lowbrow? It's all touchscreens, and nobody has any know-how. Your idea of fun is taking 1,001 photos of your duck face. Matters most to you. what the celebrity's post told you was cool, or a moral compass that points true north, oh true. I'm gonna kill this sacred cow. I'm gonna kill your 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 sacred cow.